This is Jeff Blankford. Now I'm going to take you to Edward Snowden speaking last Tuesday night to the Ornstein Hoshin public relations firm in Israel. And here is Edward Snowden, excerpts from that speech.
5 years ago, three journalists and I were sitting in this hotel room in Hong Kong. Sweat just pouring down our faces. You know, we haven't left. We all smell bad. We're working all day long. And we're waiting to see how you and the rest of the world were going to react to the first revelation of global mass surveillance. This is the idea that the National Security Agency, working in cooperation with many other intelligence groups around the world, had been making records of almost anything they could. In the United States, it was every phone call in the United States that the government could access through commercial partnerships, through letting themselves in through the back door, whatever they could get. And in the days that followed, journalists and others published documents revealing that democratic governments, right, in liberal societies had been monitoring the private activities of ordinary citizens who had done nothing wrong. Now, within a couple days, of course, the government responded. They charged me under these ancient laws that were intended to be used against spies, but they've become increasingly useful for jailing the sources of journalists, right, who are not selling secrets for their own private gain, but risking their freedom for the public benefit. Politicians, you know, they were all against us, saying everything was terrible, people were going to die. And there were moments when I wondered if all of us who were working on this project had put so much on the line for basically nothing. Because you get people in the audience, maybe some of you, who react with indifference. And they go, oh yeah, you know, everybody knew this. Of course it was happening. That kind of practiced cynicism. But now we're in the world of 2018, which is almost unrecognizable from back then. And the reality is the collection and abuse of our data is not only still being talked about, it's being talked about more. And it's this principle that once you move things from that distance, that realm of conspiracy theory, to fact, that the conversation changes. And it's not enough, but when we look at what's happened since then, now, everybody knows about this, and governments have not responded quickly enough to focus on this. And so what does this mean? Proliferation. You might be okay with the government being able to do these kind of things, right? Like, how did this happen? And the reality is surveillance technology just moves more quickly than law. And so a generation ago, this stuff was hard, this stuff was expensive, it was difficult to manage. You had people out on the street, you know, you had teams in cars, you had people wearing headphones in buildings, drilling taps into the walls. To track one person, you know, took a group. But now, one person can track a group. It's scalable, right? And so you go, all right, I don't care, I've got nothing to hide. What's the government gonna scare me with? I'm on their side. But what about those companies, right? What about that proliferation? What about other governments? Where does this go? What does the corporate side of this really look like when you have anonymous men with their machines in faraway places? You don't know their names. You can't touch them with your laws because they're not in your jurisdiction, and all they do all day long is they make lists. Facebook is probably one of the best examples of this. Google is the worst. Facebook is working real hard to get there, but they're still number two. But they're the best example because they're what we see. Google works quite hard to stay invisible. Facebook's all over the headlines. The thing is, Facebook doesn't care about you. Facebook doesn't care about your country or your politics. It doesn't care about your future or what happens to you. Facebook cares about one thing and one thing only, and that's your data. They are a surveillance company. And their product is you. What they make, what they create, what they keep to themselves and what they rent to others, it is the story of your life, the lives of your neighbors, your most private preferences. It's a record of every article you've ever bothered to click while you're logged in. But it's deeper than that. It's the people that you care about and who means the most to you among them. It's the ideas that attract you and the things that repel you. It is a system that is designed, when you take a step back, to put your mind on a shelf with a price tag that's available to anyone who's got the money. And the scary thing is, it works. Now, some of you are going to say, these are just the things that I put out there online voluntarily, right? You'd be wrong, but for the sake of argument, let's pretend that's right. And let's make it a little bit more real. Let's make it a little bit more personal. How many of you who are there, have an iPhone or an Android phone, right? A smartphone of any kind, basically everybody. So I'm going to tell you a little bit of a story here. And for those of you who are familiar with this this company, I want you to just pretend you've never heard of them. I've not made a mistake in describing them. But let's say there's a Russian cybercrime company whose entire business right now is based on the idea of developing digital burglary tools. And they go by the name of the NSO Group. And it works like this. They send you a time-sensitive text message, and it's got a link in it. It's something that you have that human impulse. You see it, you go, oh goodness, I need to check that and see what's going on with this. It could be a delivery thing for a package. It could be something that they've used, for example, in Mexico, where they say, there's people outside your house, a van, have you seen this, what's going on? And you go, oh man, I need to see what that is. You click it, as soon as you click the link, and everybody clicks the link, because they can try this 100 different times in 100 different ways, always from different number, your phone now belongs to whoever sent you that message. Everything in the entire history of your phone, they can immediately copy. Everything that happens on your phone from that day forward, every place you go, everyone you call, everything you read, every photo you take, every audio note that's been on that, or actually because they can turn the microphone on remotely, they can turn the camera on remotely even when you haven't already taken a picture. Everything that just passes by this device now, everything that your phone is a part of, this company and their customers are now a part of. And I just want you to reflect on that capability for a second. And the nature of it being created and provided by this Russian enterprise, and in their defense, the business says they only sell it to legitimate customers, police and government agencies. And they only do this for the purpose of targeting terrorists and criminals. How do you feel about that? Nobody likes terrorists and criminals. Maybe it won't affect you, maybe it won't affect people like you, ordinary people. And so you go, all right, these aren't my people. Now let me add a little bit more detail. This NSO group, and this is a real company and it's a real example, not Russian. They're actually Israeli. And they're based out of Herzliya. Right. By Tel Aviv, I think. My geography over there is a little shaky. So.
Yeah, you're correct.
And, to a lot of people in the audience, that makes this a lot less scary, right? Like, all the fear sort of deflates, except for all of those of you who already knew about this company. Because you trust your industry, maybe, more than others. It's only natural. And they sell this digital burglary tool, this software called Pegasus, to lots of people, right? The Israeli government, they surely got it, but that maybe doesn't bother you, right? What I want you to think about is who else has bought this? Who else can use this? How it happened, how you would know, how you would control this, and how much you trust, not just this company, not just your relationship with your government, it's a business model. Because this is the thing. The NSO group, they can't monopolize an entire business model. There are other groups that are going to replicate the same thing. The NSO group, in today's world, based on the evidence we have, they are the worst of the worst in selling these burglary tools that are being actively currently used to violate the human rights of, you know, dissidents, opposition figures, activists, to some pretty bad players. But they're not alone. And the idea is that companies like this increasingly are popping up all around the world, right? Israel has a phenomenally advanced tech sector, right? You guys are good at this. I mean, it's something to take pride in. But is it really cybersecurity? And these companies that represent themselves as, you know, aiding law enforcement or as cybersecurity companies, when they're creating tools, that is actually making, like, it's a kind of predation. Their business model is searching for vulnerabilities in our critical infrastructure, right? The phone that rides in your pocket every day, the systems that you rely on. Not to fix them, but to hide them. To make sure they stay open for as long as possible in order to sell access to them, to their entire chain of customers. And so this is something that I think has not gotten enough attention recently. The NSO group is special because while we do have these other guys around the world who are trying to do the same thing, we have documentation. We have a Canadian research group of academics who's managed to catch what these guys are doing because they made some mistakes and they sold it to the wrong people. And when you look at what Pegasus does and where it's gone, where it's spread, this is not just something that's being used for the defense of Israel. It's not something that's being used just for catching criminals. It's not something that's being used for saving lives and thwarting terrorist attacks. How do we know this, right? You already saw the kind of messages that they're sending there. The key is, who are they sending them to? These are to Mexican journalists, right? And it's not just journalists. They sent it to media figures. They sent it to people who are in law enforcement and lawyers. They sent it to public health officials. They sent it to, I believe, the president of the Senate in Mexico, anti-corruption groups. And how? It's not like this company outside Herzliya even knows who these people are, right? But they don't really care, because that's not their problem. And when you get this kind of widespread targeting and these methods of education, this you're teaching digital depredation widely beyond borders to these other governments, to these other groups that you can't control, you can't even see what they're doing in terms of your contracts and whatnot, because they don't want you to know, because maybe you'll leak information. It starts to be used, like on this, a journalist who put out a report that was critical of the then Mexican president. But when she didn't immediately click on it, they went to her children, right? And where does this lead? Some of you may have heard about this Saudi journalist and dissident, Jamal Khashoggi, if you follow the news. He was living in the United States, continuing with his criticism of the government at the time. And I know, you know, maybe people are trying to build better relations over there right now, but when we think about this on the level of human rights, this guy's a writer. He's not building bombs. He's not, you know, developing plots. He's writing things people don't like. And he went into the Turkish consulate. He was immediately strangled. We still don't know what happened to his body, but we know the Saudis sent 15 people into their consulates, killed this man, and they did it. This get planned? How did this come together? How did they know where he was going, when he was going? Obviously, they knew he was going to come to the consulate because he had to make an appointment. They knew he had to walk in, and when he set foot through that doorway, he was already doomed, right? But how did they know what his plans and intentions were? How did they decide that he was someone they needed to act against, who was worth the risk? And the reality is they had bugged one of his few friends and contacts using software created by a company. And, you know, we don't know the chain of consequence, because this company will never comment on this, although it's one of the major stories that's not being written about. But how much of his friend, who was also in exile in Canada, who was basically just running a YouTube channel, or kind of confiding in each other, informed these kind of efforts. And how much did these kind of operations happen every day in a thousand different ways, where these companies, right, whether they're in Israel, whether they're somewhere else, go, this is not my problem. How is it that when we have privileged and capable industries in developed countries using their powers, right, not for saving lives, but for making money, to such an extent and to such a level of recklessness and irresponsibility that it actually starts costing lives? Now, even if you agree with all of this, even if you think it's okay, even if you think these are just a couple bad apples, and by the way, there's a long history showing again and again that this is happening. If you're interested in it, the Citizen Lab has published open and public reports on the operation of this company and how their software is being used and the costs of it. But I want you to go again back to that business model, to that dynamic. This gets a little bit technical, right? But the kind of defenses that these companies put forward, besides going, well, we just sell it to police, we just sell it to law enforcement, we sell it to governments, right? These are people who we should be able to trust. And therefore, what they do after it, you know, we'll investigate if somebody tells us about it. But 9 times out of 10, no one will ever know. So it's not really a meaningful form of oversight. But even if you find all of that convincing, I want you to think about something different, which is that dynamic of proliferation. Israel has a real leg up in technology right now, particularly in these kind of offensive operations. They're really, really good, right? Even the NSA realizes that we get hacked by the Israelis, right? When we file our sort of counterintelligence priorities matrix, it's always the same four, right? You got your usual suspects, your China and Russia, right? And you also have Israel, and you also have France, right? If I were going to put these guys in the ranking, I would put Israel above France.
I don't remember that ever being published yet, right?
I'm not sure. These things are pretty common knowledge in the industry, at least. But, you know, maybe it's not. But what we have here is, let's say you have a national advantage. You start commercializing, you start selling it, and you go, we're only going to sell it to this government, blah, blah, blah. Great, that's all established, we know that. What if that government takes that tool and they infect themselves with it, right? They say we're going after terrorists, but it's actually one of their own guys. And the whole purpose of it is just to capture this exploit, this thing that gets sent to the iPhone, that link, and then copy it. And now, not only can the company no longer make money off of it, although the government is going to keep this contract alive so they can get more and more exploits, as they then use this burglary tool to get into other people who Israel and this company now have no knowledge of, they have no insight into, they don't see how this is being used because it's happening off their radar, outside of the commercial relationship, they can now use it against you. And they can use it against everybody else. And it teaches them how these things are found, it teaches them how these things are made, it teaches them where to look, right? This is not a cybersecurity industry, this is a cyber insecurity. The thing that I have to constantly remember is that we wouldn't know any of this if people weren't willing to take risks to tell us. Even the people who are in academia, who are just watching the systems, who are responding to people's forensic requests, this is not the kind of thing that makes you friends. And it's this willingness to take risks, to tell us, the public, what is being hidden from us, what nobody wants us to know, but we desperately need to know, that moves us toward a better world. We need to be willing to accept some level of risk on both an individual and social basis, if we want to actually enjoy what liberty is. Because that's what this is all about. None of us can be safe unless all of us are safe on the longest time frames. And when we start letting flags get in the way, when we start letting communities get in the way, when we start letting identities get in the way of our collective sense of purpose, when we stop talking, when we stop listening, we create borders that don't keep others out. They keep us in. And eventually, when we're in this kind of world, where we're so afraid of all of the real dangers that we know are out there, right? That we start to limit our own activities, that we start fearing and we stop daring, we stop progressing. When we stop progressing, we stop living. And look, I've sat at the desk, I've typed in the names, I've read the communications, right? Terrorists are real, and some of them are very dangerous. But the thing that there are not a lot of people that are willing to say, but I think most of us who read the news, particularly in your neighborhood, see, is that these are also not rocket scientists, right? It's rare to have the evil mastermind. And if we can allow ourselves to be terrorized by someone with nothing but a knife, to reorder our societies for the convenience of state power, or we refuse to regulate the kind of corporate power, both domestically and internationally, that actually starts to shape policy and boundaries in our future, we've stopped being citizens, and we've started being subjects. We've stopped being proactive and deciding where we're going. We've started permitting other people to make those decisions for us. The thing that's particularly scary about governments relative to companies is governments actually use this to create kinetic effects, to put people in cages, to end lives. Companies enable this, but they do not direct it in quite the same way. Moreover, even the most privileged companies have limitations on what they can access. They have their data, but not their competitors. In today's world, anybody who can stamp a warrant can get data from every company. And this creates a different sort of magnitude of threat. There's also the question of application. This corporate data collection is being made available to many, many, many more groups. And this creates a different character of threat.
You talked to us about NSO, which I think everybody in the audience is aware of them, at least in a certain level. But how different, how outstanding is that in the whole world of private commercial surveillance? I mean, is Israel different than other nations, other companies who deal with the same kind of profession?
Is that in the Israeli model, there is a closer level of collaboration between the corporate and the state. In the United States after 2013, you saw all of these big technology companies who had been very eagerly and aggressively cooperating with the United States government far beyond what the law required. Microsoft, Google, Apple, Facebook, all these guys, Yahoo as well. Trying to distance themselves, like, oh, you don't understand it, oh, it's a little bit wrong, and you know, we're gonna change things, this will never happen again. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't see that happening too frequently. I think that's one of the differences.
Wait, the line was cut, can you repeat the last sentence, please?
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't see that same reaction typically happening in Israel.
Not so much. No, but you know, maybe that is happening for a reason, because I think Israelis do love freedom, but they love security even more. And you know when you have the knife on your throat or rockets falling over your home every day? So, you know, maybe you will not risk your life for digital freedom so easily. I mean, isn't it natural to prefer life and security over freedom of speech if that's the choice you have to make?
Well, we certainly see it's persuasive, right, in terms of political influence. We have seen this same argument made in the United States and France and Germany and the UK. If you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. But we all forget the origins of this, or at least we elide the origins because we go into convenient and persuasive argument, and it's from Nazi Germany. Right? This is not saying that everybody who repeats it is a Nazi, but we have divorced the statement from its origin. And the reality is, when you look at what that argument is intended to do, it's a rhetorical trick. It is designed to change the burden of argument from being on the government to explain why they need to intervene, to show evidence to a court, to go, we want to monitor this person, we suspect them of association with a terrorist group, we suspect them of being a criminal, to instead putting it on society at every individual level and saying, we need you to justify why you need your rights. But if you have to justify your rights, you're not living in a liberal society. And this is what we forget. Look, everybody is scared everywhere in our lifetimes. Some people, some countries, some locations feel this more acutely than others. But we have to recognize this isn't about digital freedom, right? This is about capital F freedom. Your online life is your offline life today. There's not a distinction, it's not theoretical, right? Your phone knows more about you than you do. And when we start going, oh, we're gonna make exceptions, we're gonna go, this doesn't matter for this, that, or the other, I don't need this right because of where I am today, because I'm safe, I'm protected, right? Or I'm not a threat, nobody should be afraid of me. I'm not interesting, I'm not an oppositionist, I'm an activist. What you're saying is that everybody who is different, who does need this right, they don't deserve the same level of protection. But who moves society forward, right? The inventors, the writers, speaking, they are the ones who are different, right? The orthodoxy is not interesting. Orthodoxy is not something new. It is our differences, our heresies, that are the seed of progress. And it is privacy that produces these differences. We know from study after study that when people think they're being watched, they begin to act differently. There's a kind of, we call it performative surveillance, right? Where you show people they're being watched, and then people act as if they're being watched because they know they're being judged by people who are not them, who don't understand what they care about, what they think about, who they are, who they love, and they just don't want people to make mistakes, because when we start talking about state power, and when we start talking more and more about corporate power, it does have real-world effects, right? When they start deciding who gets a job, who gets a loan, who can travel. All of these things are based on the idea that surveillance reaches the correct conclusion. And anyone who has ever worked in intelligence, who doesn't admit that intelligence gets things wrong, and frequently, because that's the nature of intelligence, is lying. They're being deceptive. But they do get it right sometimes. And it's this understanding that things are wrong, that things are indeterminate. You can get as close to shore as you can, and all of these models miss when we start making decisions on the basis of records about people at scale. The collection of everything about everyone, not because we think they've done anything wrong, but because we want to have it in case we develop an interest in them. This is called the bulk collection regime. But what the bulk collection regime does is the creation of a surveillance time. Every utterance, every thought, every purchase we've made, everything we've read, everywhere we've gone, everyone we've met, begins to be recorded. and databased and stored to the best of our capability. And right now it's not forever, but with each year it gets closer to forever. To where we start to realize what surveillance is actually about. Surveillance is not about safety. Surveillance is about control. These are similar but distinct concepts, right? Surveillance is an expression of power. And when we allow ourselves to be surveilled to a certain level, right, when there are mists with all of our data, and the structures of power change, we have very little ability to resist them. We have very little ability to change them, right? And we start to begin to be acted upon exclusively by those who hold and influence these levers of power. And while you might be comfortable thinking it is the state today, what is that going to look like in 5 years and 10 years? Never more than one election away from even the best of countries. But what happens as corporate influence continues to increase and government influence may begin to recede because we start to express our technologies through fundamental laws, universal laws, right? Physics, math, science, that a court order cannot overcome. And so the laws that we write down become less influential. This cuts both ways, right? And I think the thing that people need to remember is that losing rights, that's a one-way ratchet, right? These aren't things that are temporary. These aren't things that are transient. Everybody, you know, out there understands this. This ratchet only tightens. And once you've lost a certain amount of that, you can ask nicely, you can hope, you can pray, you can protest. But you can't actually impose your will on the structures that you're answerable to. Now, a lot of people in Israel go, look, I don't care about this. I trust my government. I identify with my government. My government's helping me. Okay, fine, right? But think about the future that you want your children to have. Think about the world that you want everybody to live in, right? I love my flag, right? I am an American. I want to get back home. And I love my country. But I love my world more. And when we lose sight of this, when we forget that, you know, arguing that I have nothing to hide is no different than saying I don't care about free speech because I have nothing to say, is an abdication of responsibility as a person in this world. This world will only ever be as good as we make it. And if we are constantly afraid, if we are constantly hiding, if we are constantly making the same choices, if we are afraid to speak, if we are afraid to be different, if we are afraid to go, look, I don't have something to hide, I have something to protect, and that's the kind of liberal and open society that I want to live in.
And that with a buzz was an excerpt from a talk by former NSA contractor, become whistleblower Ed Snowden, speaking from Moscow by video to a conference in Israel last Tuesday. Snowden decided to accept the speaking invitation despite friends urging him to observe the growing international boycott of Israel. And while he told the audience he opposed Israel's occupation, he believes that talking is important. This has been Jeff Blankfort. Thanks for listening.